Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Continuing to read from presidential historian Michael Betschloss's Presidents of War and his essay on President Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Vietnam War. We pick up the story in early 1965 after Johnson was sworn in following his election in 1964 in November, with the war in Vietnam on the verge of escalating and the contention in the Capitol about whether to escalate or not. President Johnson told his old friend, Senator Everett Dirksen, the Senate Republican leader in Congress, that the North Vietnamese can't come bomb us, kill our people, and expect us to go into a cave. To his delight, Senator Dirksen replied that his only mistake had been not to have attacked North Vietnam hard enough, invoking the appeasement of pre-war Nazi Germany, as well as the domino theory. President Johnson replied, "We know from Munich on that when you give, the dictators feed on raw meat. If they take South Vietnam, they take Indonesia, they take Burma, they come right on back to the Philippines." President Johnson was outraged to find that his own vice president, Hubert Humphrey, wished to get out of Vietnam. Humphrey wrote him that involvement in a full-scale war would not make sense to the majority of the American people. Humphrey conceded that it was always hard to cut losses, but for the newly elected President Johnson, 1965 is the year of minimum political risk. As Hubert Humphrey later recalled, his letter made Johnson so angry that Johnson threw him into political limbo. Johnson was trying to expand his struggle against North Vietnam by stealth. When the U.S. Embassy in Saigon confirmed in late February that the United States had used B-57 and F-100 jet bombers for the first time against the Viet Cong, Johnson complained to Secretary of State Dean Rusk that this news looked desperate and dramatic, and that all of TV was heralding an entirely new policy. That month, President Johnson had quietly approved Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's proposed Operation Rolling Thunder, a gradual sustained bombing campaign intended to ratchet up pressure against the North. But privately, as Johnson started escalating the war, he was gloomily unable to convince himself that it would ultimately lead to victory. In a telephone call to the Secretary of Defense on Friday morning, February 26, 1965, he spoke these bone-chilling words: "Now we're off to bombing these people. We've over that hurdle. I don't think anything is going to be as bad as losing, and I don't see any way of winning." To this day, it is difficult to understand how this big-hearted man, Lyndon Johnson, could have brought himself to send young Americans to risk their lives in a conflict for which, even at the start, privately seemed to have so little hope. No earlier chief executive, not even Madison, had pushed Americans into a major war with such initial pessimism. Flouting the precedents for transparency set by some earlier war presidents of the United States, on Monday, March 1, 1965, Johnson told Secretary of Defense McNamara to unleash Rolling Thunder without public announcement. But that same day, the New York Times reported that the highest U.S. officials in Saigon were confiding that Johnson had decided to open a continuing limited air war. McNamara told the president, "I don't know how in the world that came out." Furious at the leak, Johnson snapped, "Am I wrong in saying that this appears to be almost traitorous? Somebody ought to be removed, Bob." Johnson added that it was not good to say that we've got a plan to bomb this specific area before we're bombing it, because, Christ, I guess every anti-aircraft and everything they can get is alerted. The next day, Rolling Thunder began with more than 100 U.S. aircraft, more planes than have ever been used in a single day against North Vietnam, striking a munitions depot and Navy base. During the following 3 years, Operation Rolling Thunder would unload more bombs on the North than struck all of Europe during World War II. As if to make up for the private helplessness he seemed to feel about the general contours of the war, President Johnson made sure that he scrutinized the aerial forays, boasting, "They can't hit an outhouse without my permission." Poignantly, the president stayed up late into the night, hoping for assurance that his boys had returned safely, saying later, "I want to be called every time somebody dies." After the first mission, a Situation Room duty officer called Johnson very early on Tuesday, March 2nd, to report that two planes were probably missing. Johnson asked, "What's it look like? Are two pilots lost?" He was told that rescue efforts were underway, and later that while six U.S. aircraft had been shot down, five of the pilots had survived. Lady Bird Johnson, his wife, told her diary that her husband can't separate himself from it. "Actually, I don't want him to, no matter how painful." By Friday, Johnson was pondering General Westmoreland's request for Marines to protect U.S. flyers and air bases in South Vietnam, which Dean Rusk, Robert McNamara, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had approved. The president told advisor Mac Bundy, "Now the Marines, I haven't made that decision. I'm still worried about it." Bundy told him, "3,500, two battalions, how far do you want us to go?" Johnson suggested that Robert McNamara consult the Armed Services Committee in Congress. Bundy replied, he didn't want to give them much leeway. He didn't want to get you a lot of advice not to do it. Johnson darkly predicted, they're going to say not to do it later. The next day, the president told Senator Russell, "I guess we've got no choice, but it scares the death out of me. I think everybody's going to think, we're landing the Marines, we're off to battle." Johnson predicted that North Vietnam would get them in a fight, just sure as hell. They're not going to run. Then you're tied down. Senator Russell replied, "We've gone so damn far, Mr. President, it scares the life out of me, but I don't know how to back up now." "That is exactly right," said Johnson. "We're getting in worse." Morosely, the president confided, "The great trouble I'm under. A man can fight if he can see daylight down the road somewhere. But there ain't no daylight in Vietnam." "There's no end to the road," replied Senator Russell. "There's just nothing." Johnson agreed. "The more bombs you drop, the more nations you scare, the more people you make mad, the more embassies you get." Russell said, "It's the worst mess I ever saw in my life." Johnson exclaimed, "If they'd say I inherited it, I'll be lucky, but they'll all say I created it." 2 hours later, the president told Robert McNamara that if there's no alternative, he could send the Marines to protect the U.S. airmen. "My answer is yes, but my judgment is no." Straining for optimism, Johnson estimated the Marines' chance of fighting with the Viet Cong and really starting a land war is maybe 60-40 against. Perhaps they might prevent it. But the psychological impact would be bad, with every American mother saying, "Uh-oh, this is it." Johnson asked his defense secretary whether they could buffer the political shock by using some euphemism for Marines, such as military police. McNamara replied, "No, sir, we really can't say that. They're quite different from the MPs, and all the press knows it." He pledged to minimize the announcement, but warned that it could provoke a lot of headlines. Johnson replied, "You're telling me?" On Sunday evening in private with Lady Bird Johnson, he was disconsolate about his oncoming war. "I can't get out, and I can't finish it with what I've got, and I don't know what the hell to do." In April 1965, hoping to avert further dramatic escalation, the president publicly offered Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam $1 billion to develop the Mekong River Delta, so long as Ho would guarantee the freedom of the South Vietnam. But the money was refused. Robert McNamara and General Westmoreland that month persuaded Johnson to approve 9 new battalions for Vietnam, which would increase U.S. forces there to 82,000 soldiers. The president asked Congress for $700 million to meet mounting military requirements in Vietnam, poignantly adding that his request was not routine. He warned that every legislature who endorsed it was also voting to persist in our efforts to halt communist aggression in South Vietnam. Johnson knew that this would be an easy sell, explaining to Hubert Humphrey that if the House and Senate refused him, he could tell them in public, "You're not giving a man ammunition he needs for his gun. You got him standing out naked and letting people shoot at him." He told Congressman George Mahone of House Appropriations Committee that he was being frank and candid and open with them. He asked Senator John Stennis of Mississippi to show Hanoi that we got the money and that the Congress is behind us. The House and Senate backed the president almost unanimously, but the newly elected Robert Kennedy told colleagues on the Senate floor that his yes vote should not be taken as a blank check for any wider war. Escalation, Kennedy warned, could bring hundreds of thousands of American troops to Vietnam and might easily lead to nuclear warfare. Johnson complained to Robert McNamara, who had maintained his friendship with the New York senator, that Kennedy was making little snide remarks in the Senate cloakroom that the president had manipulated the Congress on Vietnam. "You just got to sit down and talk to Bobby." After still another coup, the Saigon junta was replaced in early June by a new prime minister, Air Force General Ninh Cao Cai, who wore a zippered flight suit with pearl-handled revolvers and later said his country needed four or five Hitlers, as well as a new head of state, General Ninh Van Thu. Bill Bundy called the duo absolutely the bottom of the barrel. McNamara warned Johnson that they faced a very dangerous situation. General Maxwell Taylor, the new U.S. envoy in Saigon, reported if there should be a new Viet Cong offensive, exploiting the monsoon season, which could make it harder to defend ground troops from the air, it will probably be necessary to commit U.S. ground forces in action. Some of the Joint Chiefs of Staff now advised Johnson to bomb Hanoi. The president told congressional friends that he had stalled them off by warning that this might force China to enter the war. He warned Senator Vance Hartke, Democrat from Indiana, "If you'd see what some of the Joint Chiefs are recommending here to me, you'd drop the phone and go see your grandchild." Johnson later reported to Senator Russell that some of the military leaders were awfully irresponsible. "They'll just scare you. They're ready to put up a million men in right quick." Senator Russell Long, Democrat from Louisiana, told Johnson, "We may have to face up to the $64,000 question and bomb China." Finding the president very pessimistic about Vietnam, Senator Mike Mansfield of Montana implored him not to bomb the North's capital city. On Monday, June 7th, General Westmoreland wired Robert McNamara from Saigon that he urgently needed 41,000 more combat forces and 52,000 later on, which would mean a total of 175,000 troops in Vietnam. McNamara argued that the United States must abandon its defensive posture and take the war to the enemy, in which case even greater forces may be required. McNamara told colleagues, "We're in a hell of a mess." Long afterward, he called General Westmoreland's bombshell the most disturbing cable he ever received as Secretary of Defense, explaining, "We could no longer postpone a choice about what path to take." Calling the president, McNamara now said to him, "Unless we're really willing to go to a full potential land war, we've got to slow down here and try to halt, at some point, the ground troop commitment." The president refused, noting that the North was putting their stack in and moving new chips into the pot. The choice, he said, was either tuck tail and run or respond to those who were telling the United States, "The Indians are coming." McNamara reported that Robert Kennedy was asking Johnson to explain to the American people on television how far we're going to go. The president said, "I can't do it, can I?" McNamara replied, "No, no, you can't." Johnson asked him, stating, "Do you know how far we're going to go? Or do the Joint Chiefs know? What human being knows? I would imagine if they wiped out 1,000 boys tomorrow, we might go a hell of a lot further than we do if they just wiped out four. We're trying to be prudent. Now, not a damn human thinks that 50,000 or 100,000 or 150,000 are going to end the war, and we're not getting out. To gauge the attitude of the doves, the president called Mike Mansfield, confiding that his military people were warning that our 75,000 men are going to be in great danger unless they have 75,000 more. But then they'll have to have another 150. Then they'll have to have another 150. The majority leader said, "We've got too many in there now. Where do you stop?" Johnson replied, "You don't. To me, it's shaping up like this, Mike. You either get out or you get in." But Hanoi and Haiphong are spit clean and have been for months, said Mike Mansfield. You bomb them, you get nothing. You just build up more hatred. Johnson replied, "I think that's true," adding that the United States had done nearly everything that you can do except make it a complete white man's war. Mike Mansfield, who had once taught Asian history, cautioned, "If you do that, then you might as well say goodbye to all of Asia and to most of the world." The president later told former President Dwight Eisenhower that, according to his intelligence, many Chinese, Soviet, and North Vietnamese officials had concluded that we almost got a Civil War Congress again, with all of them telling every day what ought to be done. And although it wasn't true, that a good many of them are sympathetic with the communists. Even at this early stage of the war, Johnson knew the enemy was not likely to give up. General Westmoreland cabled that, short of decision to introduce nuclear weapons against sources and channels of enemy power, I see no likelihood of achieving a quick, favorable end to the war. Johnson reminded Dwight Eisenhower that Ho Chi Minh said he'd fight on for 20 years if he needed to. He predicted to Senator Birch Bayh of Idaho that ultimately the Viet Cong would last longer than we do, because their soldier was willing to hide out in a rut for 2 days without water, food, or anything, and never moves, waiting to ambush somebody. Now an American, he stays there about 20 minutes, and goddamn, he's got to get him a cigarette. That month, the president told Robert McNamara, "I'm very depressed about it, but I see no program from either defense or state that gives me much hope of doing anything except just praying and gasping to hold on during Monsoon and hope they'll quit. I don't believe they're ever going to quit, and I don't see that we have any plan for a victory militarily or diplomatically." In late June 1965, seeking comfort, Johnson called Harry Truman in Independence, Missouri, and said, "I thought I might invite myself out to see you," adding that he could stay in a tourist court near the Kansas City airport. He would be on his way to make a speech in San Francisco on the 20th anniversary of the United Nations. He told former President Truman, "I remember how much you did for them and how you saved them in Korea." Johnson turned the telephone over to a visitor, Justice Arthur Goldberg of the U.S. Supreme Court, who joked with former President Truman, "Do you feel peppy enough to seize the steel industry again if we act up against the president here?" With cold candor, Johnson told McNamara at the start of July, "We know ourselves in our own conscience that when we asked for this Gulf of Tonkin resolution, we had no intention of committing this many ground troops. We're doing so now, and we know it's going to be bad. And the question is, do we just want to do it out on a limb by ourselves?" He warned that if they did not consult Congress before a major escalation of the war, you'd have a long debate about not having asked them. That same week, Johnson confided to Lady Bird Johnson, "Vietnam is getting worse every day. I have the choice to go in with great casualty lists or to get out with disgrace. It's like being in an airplane, and I have to choose between crashing the plane or jumping out. I do not have a parachute." Lady Bird told her diary, "When he is pierced, I bleed. It's a bad time all around." On Thursday, July 22, 1965, Johnson made his decision. At 5:30 that morning, agitated in his bed, he turned, woke up Lady Bird, and told her in torment, "I don't want to get into a war, and I don't see any way out of it. I've got to call up 600,000 boys, make them leave their homes and their families. Lady Bird told her journal, feeling like the boy that leaves the burning deck. I went to my own room to try to get another hour or two of sleep, fitful and unsatisfactory. That afternoon, the president asked the Joint Chiefs of Staff whether, if he approved General Westmoreland's request for new troops, we are in a new war and this is going off the diving board. McNamara replied that they had been relying on the South Vietnamese to carry the brunt, but now we would be responsible for the war's outcome. Johnson asked, do all of you think that Congress and the people will go along with 600,000 people and billions of dollars 10,000 miles away? Stanley Resor, Secretary of the Army, insisted that most Americans supported the obligation in Vietnam. Johnson replied, but if you make a commitment to jump off a building and you find out how high it is, you may want to withdraw the commitment. The president was counseled by some to declare a state of national emergency, as he himself had urged on President Truman during the Korea War, asking Americans for higher taxes and other forms of sacrifice. But recalling how Truman's proclamation had damaged his popularity, Johnson refused, especially while he was still imploring Congress to enact the cornerstones of his great society. Instead, he would announce his escalation in a low-key manner. With biting humor, he explained, if you have a mother-in-law with only one eye, and she has it in the center of her forehead, you just don't keep her in the living room. Johnson told Senator Russell of Georgia that General Westmoreland, an old South Carolina boy, had been out there meeting with them long enough, and he's getting fed up with it. Russell warned Johnson, you shouldn't send many more than 100,000 over there. The senator noted that the South Vietnamese leader, General Khai, that little old mustachioed fellow, had proposed that we ought to fight the war and his troops ought to pacify the villages in the rear. God, that scared the hell out of me. If they're going to fight that kind of war, I'm in favor of getting out of there. Senator Russell recalled that by contrast, in the early 1950s, the South Koreans had fought every inch of the way. Referring to Justice Arthur Goldberg, whom he had just persuaded to quit the Supreme Court in order to help him end the Vietnam War to be ambassador to the United Nations, Johnson told Senator Russell that he was going to do everything I can with this Jew to find a way to get out of without saying so. He added that he didn't plan to dramatize his escalation. Russell agreed, if that's the way you're going to play it, I'd play it down. Russell advised him to call up the reserves, but the president disagreed, saying that it would be too dramatic and puts me out there further than I want to get right at this moment. Briefing congressional leaders, Johnson confessed, we all know that it is a bad situation, and we wish that we were 10 years back or even 10 months back. Henry Cabot Lodge, who had been envoy to Saigon and was about to resume that post, claimed that pulling out of Vietnam would be worse than a victory for the Kaiser or Hitler in the two world wars. Everett Dirksen pledged that as leader of the opposition in the Senate, he would not behave like the Committee on the Conduct of the War that had dogged former President Abraham Lincoln. Speaker McCormick assured the president that they were united behind him, along with all true Americans. Johnson rejected suggestions to announce his big decision before a joint session of Congress or in an Oval Office TV address. Instead, at 12:30 in the afternoon on Wednesday, July 28th, he read out a brief statement on Vietnam during a regular East Room press conference, along with announcements that he was naming NBC's John Chancellor to lead the Voice of America and his old friend Abe Fortas to replace Arthur Goldberg on the Supreme Court. Sitting in the front row, Lady Bird Johnson dabbed her eyes with a handkerchief as her husband acknowledged, speaking very slowly, that people were asking why young Americans must toil and suffer and sometimes die in such a remote, distant place. Vietnam, he said, was a different kind of war. If the United States were driven out, then no nation, again, would have the same confidence in an American protection. Surrender would not bring peace, as we learned from Hitler at Munich. Citing General Westmoreland's request,
he announced that he would raise our fighting strength from 75,000 to 125,000 men almost immediately. Additional forces will be needed later, and they will be sent as requested. Revealing his ambivalence, Johnson confessed, "I do not find it easy to send the flower of our youth, our finest young men, into battle. This is the most agonizing and the most painful duty of your president. But unless a nation stood up against men who hate and destroy, then all our dreams for freedom, all will be swept away on the flood of conquest. So, too, this shall not happen. We shall stand in Vietnam." A reporter asked how long the war would take. Johnson replied that there would be no quick solution, adding that after Pearl Harbor, no one really knew whether World War II would take 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. Asked when he thought Congress for a war declaration, the president replied, "That would depend on the circumstances." During his speech the following week, he gave no hint of his private doubts about the war and told the crowd, "America wins the wars that she undertakes. Make no mistake about it." This concludes the reading today about Lyndon Johnson and his increasingly involvement in the Vietnam War in presidential historian Michael Beschloss's book, The Presidents of War.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.